My name is Mike Mattuzzi. I'm the founder of Contemporary Spirituality, and I am delighted this afternoon to be sitting down with Sister Ilya. Ilya, thanks for agreeing to this interview.
Sure, Mike. Nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you. You and I have known each other for, I don't know when, 5 or 6 years, and you've been to Kansas City a couple times. We've had packed houses here both times, and I was on your board for a couple years. So I feel like I know you pretty well, not only just kind of on a one-to-one relationship, but just also on following your books and your work. And so anyway, that's kind of our background. But I just read over the weekend your new book, Birth of a Dancing Star, which is kind of your memoir. This is just delightful, and I hope to kind of touch on that. Folks will be familiar with you from your written work and from your speaking events, but I think kind of the up close and personal is the folks that listeners, the stuff that listeners tend to like. So
right.
If we can kind of start there, is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine, Mike. Mm-hmm.
All
yes.
Right.
Happy to.
Birth of a Dancing Star, Ilya. Why that title?
The title, well, I was always struck by a line from the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, out of chaos, a star is born. And I thought, you know, that sort of typifies my life. Chaos being, it didn't unfold in the way that when I was a kid, I had a lot of goals. I was very goal-oriented, and I thought exactly this is how my life is supposed to work. And it didn't work out that way at all. yet there's a great sense of goodness and light in my life. And so I think, you know, it's been chaotic, but maybe I'm the story that God maybe had in mind and what I didn't have in mind. So it was kind of a fun title and a creative title.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. I love this story about a fire in our midst, which really gets to how your parents decided to name you Denise.
Yeah.
But walk through that. That's just lovely. And you told me bits and pieces before, but to see it in writing helped understand it better.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So when my mother was pregnant with me, they were, you know, I was the last of four children, and my parents were already in their early 40s. And so they had a lot of concern about having another child at, you know, this middle age of life. But so they were going through all sorts of names. And one of their good friends, the Giacones, they had a 12-year-old son by the name of Dennis. And Dennis was, Pat and Della went out one day, and Dennis asked to stay home to work on a Boy Scout project. And the project was building an ant trap. And apparently he put kerosene in the ant trap and lit it. And unfortunately, his clothes caught fire. And before long, he was in flames running down the street, screaming for help. And finally, a neighbor saw him. But by the time they brought him to the hospital, he was covered with third-degree burns. And this was back in the 50s when, you know, we didn't have the kind of medical care we have now for fire burns. Anyway, my mother, I think, was, she was about in her 7th or 8th month with me. And they went to visit Dennis in the hospital. And he said, you know, you're having a baby. And she said, well, Dennis, she said, if it's a boy, we'll name him after you, Dennis. And if it's a girl, it will be Denise. And he died. He died, you know, shortly before I was born. And so I was named Denise for Dennis, who died in a fire. And that was always very significant to me, that story. And then I think, you know, then my mother told me that the hospital in which I was born in, Columbus Hospital, that burned down too. There seems to be something about fire, like where I go, fire seems to be there. And so I take that as being a, I'm hoping that, you know, that has waned a little bit, but I think that's transferred now into a spiritual fire, you know?
Yes.
So it's always, So I'm named for a fire. And then I think I mentioned the Pseudo Dionysius, you know, the mystic of the 5th century, you know, again, you know, this image of fire is kind of pronounced for spiritual writers, like mystical writers like Pseudo Dionysius and Bonaventure, you know, this kind of passion, you know, fire was a symbol of passion. So I thought, well, that's appropriate too. So, yeah.
How about your upbringing? Raised in New Jersey, Italian American family, and then you also describe yourself as a cradle Catholic. Can you unpack that a little bit more for the listeners?
Yeah. So cradle Catholic, I think that's a good term, you know, born into an Italian American Catholic family. And so Catholic for us then, you know, in late 50s and 60s and 70s, it was like, you know, you go to church on Sunday and Father, you know, you listen to what Father says and you obey the church and you go to the devotions. We went to the St. Anthony devotion every Tuesday, you know, fish fries on Friday. And it was sort of a community of, you know, it was more like a social community of Catholic believers. And so it was piety, devotions, and Sunday Mass, I think, you know, really comprised cradle Catholicism. And, you know, it's like you wouldn't think about, you know, dating a certain type of person, or you wouldn't think about, you know, divorce and remarriage because, you know, the church says these things. So everything, you know, was, this is what the church says. And, you know, a big sense of like heaven and hell and original sin. These are all kind of, I don't think I paid that much attention, quite honestly, to all those other things. But, you know, the going to Mass on Sunday was, you know, that was our thing. And then St. Anthony devotion on Tuesday, that was kind of neat. I kind of like that one. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now, you have a chapter in the book that says, "No angel am I," which I found to be hysterical, just kind of what a big prankster you are in high school, and how I think you said you never took notes or never studied or something. But that really, you know, my memory of you is being at these Richard Rohr or being at these Living School teachings where you had, you know, 420 slides for a 45-minute presentation, just so organized and so on point, and just using, you know, every minute, maximizing every minute. So tell us about that stretch. I think the listeners will be fascinated with kind of your wild streak.
So my parents, because I was, you know, my brothers and sisters were out of the house by the time I was 5 years old, and they worried I'd become a sociopath or something, you know, because I spent a lot of time by myself. I like to write and I love music. Yeah. And so I just entertained myself, and they thought it'd be good if I had some sociality. So they sent me to an all-girls boarding school in Sloatsburg, New York. And the school was run by Ukrainian nuns. And, you know, I thought, well, this is novel, you know. And it was really like, if you've ever seen the movie The Trouble with Angels, I was of that ilk, you know, it wasn't attention-seeking. It was just, how far can I push this boundary? You know, my best friend was Vicky Formica, an Italian lady from Brooklyn, New York. And we spent most of our time, you know, of our high school years, short sheeting beds. I mean, you know, greasing oil knobs. We just spent our time creating new pranks, you know, putting starch in the nuns' laundry. we used to take food from the kitchen and then charge the students on these long excavations, you know, these excursions around this beautiful lake that was behind the school.
Yeah.
And so, it's true. I don't remember taking notes. You know, I would sit in class writing notes to everyone else, you know, and, I honestly, sometimes I don't know how I really did as well as I did. I had a good memory. That was, you know, thanks be to God. I mean, I could hear something and then it would stick for the most part. But I spent most of my time just wondering how I could, you know, make people's lives miserable or, you know, kind of just upset them a little bit just for fun. We once changed all the statues in the school. We turned their backs around. So all the set, you know. Yeah, and then we changed the whole card catalog around one time. Like if you opened A, you got Z. If you opened C, you got F. Yeah, so the nuns weren't too happy with us, you know, because we really made their lives probably more chaotic than they needed to be. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, quite honestly. I enjoyed playing pranks.
And this was a very conservative order, right? The Byzantine,
well,
right?
It was conservative. The sisters did wear a habit, and we all wore school uniforms, and, you know, they had to be of a certain length. We wore chapel veils to, and of course, you know, we were always, because we were pranksters, you know, always pushing the habit, so to speak. So I think one time we took the nuns' habits and we put them on, and we would lower our, you know, uniforms to the floor. And we did really crazy. It was conservative in that way. They were trying to make us into orderly, nice, you know, women. I think they even tried giving us etiquette, you know, rules, which we broke, you know, conscientiously.
Sure. Okay. Tell us about the vocation path. At some point, you decided you had a vocation and you entered the, I think, Carmelite monastery, but walk us through that the decision-making attendant to that.
Right. Well, you know, when I was at the boarding school at St. Mary's, that it really goes back there, and it goes back to the connection with fire, because I think, as I recount in the book, I was invited to a dance at West Point. So we were not too far from West Point, and,
right,
you know, going to a dance with cadets seemed like a good idea. And while I was there, it was a Friday night, and I was just sitting around in the living room with one of the sisters, and we were talking about giving away things, like something from the Gospels, you know, where Jesus says, if you sell all your own and follow me, type thing. And the next morning, there was like a 5-state alarm of fire, you know, fire alarm on the property where the sisters had the school. Was a beautiful Tudor home that was the home of the novitiate for the sisters. And that novitiate had caught an electrical fire and was burning to the ground. And the novices, you know, got out in time, but they lost everything. And I was sort of caught up in that fire, running back and forth, trying to, you know, get some clothes for the novices. And it was a really, how would I say, chaotic experience, you know.
Sure.
But I remember that night, as I was getting ready to go to this dance at West Point, I felt this incredible, overpowering love of God. It was like it like stopped me in my tracks, you know. And I just felt in that moment like my life belonged to God, you know, entirely. And it was a real, like an indelible, like as if like a seal was placed on my heart, you know, like a wax seal. And it was like spellbinding. It turned me around, and I said, oh my God, what happened? And, you know, I went to this sister Helena, and I said, you know, something has happened. And she kind of, you know, looked at me like she kind of knew something. And I said, it was a strange, one of those inexplicable moments of the spirit. And I went to the dance, and I did meet this 6'4" cadet who was very nice, but I was like, no way, you know, like something happened in that moment. And then I said to my parents, you know, like, I would like to, I think I want to be a sister, like a missionary. And they said, absolutely not. You're not doing that. They said, you have to go to college first before you make any decision like that. And I thought, oh, that's terrible, you know, to wait all that time. But I did. And then, I went to college. And then, you know, college leads grad school. And like every young kid, you go through the phases, right? So I went through the phases of rebellion. And then I went through the phases of like, well, maybe God, you know, maybe that's just an idea that we concocted, you know, the kind of agnostic phase. But in college, I actually went to Mass probably almost every day. You know, I went to a Catholic college. And so that initial call was always there. And then finally, you know, in grad school, I came across the life of Thomas Merton. Never heard of him. Never heard of the contemplative life. And so I was really mesmerized by that. And when I read his life and then I read The Seven Story Mountain, I said, that's it. That's what I want to do. And so I finished my doctorate and I went home and I said, I am going to become a contemplative nun. And
wow.
they thought I was brainwashed or, you know, had joined a cult or something, you know, that there was something wrong with me. My parents didn't deal with it well initially. And it was hard because I had spent all this time in school and I just finished a doctorate and then I was about to leave it all for to join a very traditional, very strict Carmelite monastery. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, how did you decide upon the Carmelites? Very strict and very contemplative and really very cloistered.
Yes.
How did you decide on that?
Right. So after reading Merton, you know, and his going to the Trappist, I wanted something like the Trappist. I didn't know there were Trappistine nuns. I didn't know anything, truthfully. So I contacted my friend from high school, Sister Helena, and she said, well, I have worked with a group of Carmelite nuns, Byzantine Rite Carmelite nuns, in their bakery, and I can introduce you to them. So she did, you know, and they were in Sugarloaf, Pennsylvania, like past the Poconos. And just entering into that world was just like, it was like stepping out of this world and entering into a whole different new world.
Sure.
And very, very, very simple life. I mean, they wore a long habit, you know, to the floor, the traditional habit, literally. I mean, with a cincture, a leather belt, and sandals. They didn't wear shoes. They were Carmelite, discalced, I mean, shoeless. So I thought, wow, you know, like, and I was really drawn to that, you know, to the austerity and the simplicity and the, you know, leaving the world to live for God alone, you know, to go to the desert to find Christ. That was very, very attractive.
Mm.
So that's what I did. I went home and I sold all that I owned or gave it away and went to the Carmelites. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And your vocation was not a passing thing. I mean, it's you go over, you know, I felt called by God. I mean, that was a dominant theme in your life. I think there were different periods of time where you were more and more aware of it, but you had kind of that dominant knowledge for a long time, did you not?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's true, Mike. I mean, ever since I was a little kid, when I was a kid, like about 7 or 8 years old, my best friends were Saints Peter and Paul. You know, like I would consult with them. You know, like Peter, Paul, and I don't know if I got that from Peter, Paul, and Mary, which is a group that my brother really liked. I knew it wasn't Peter, Paul, and Mary, the singers. It was Saints Peter and Paul. But, you know, I would check with them, like, you know, should we take Shakespeare for a walk? Should we go ride our bike? You know, should we? And so there was always a deep sense of a deep presence of God in my life ever since, even as a small kid, you know.
Yeah.
And I think at 3 years old, I told like my mother's aunt, her sister was a nun for a period of time, maybe about 10 years or so. And I once said, you know, I'm going to be a nun like you someday at 3 years old. You know, so I had some deep inner sense, like, you know, God was with me and I belonged to God. That was just it, you know, and that never has left, quite honestly, after all these years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the prophetic piece is very dominant, too. You kind of always have the sense that I am to be a prophet of sorts. You know, maybe early in your life it was pushing the envelope as a prankster, but that prophet piece, can you unwind that a little bit? Because that's dominant in the book as well.
Yeah, that's true, Mike. I've always had a sense of not only being called, but God has something for me to do. I mean, it was like a sense of mission. And I never really connected it with my prankster side of, you know, my teenage years. But there is something about that connection. I think that's part of even the way I think about things. I always want to look at it from a way that no one's looking. You know, I want to turn it upside down and inside out. And I'm quite at home with the fact that God is okay with that. You know, there's something like about God's presence in my life and that that calling out to a future that no one else is really seeing at this point, which is in a sense maybe what I'm called to do. So I've always been the type that to be true to the spirit at work in me. You know, I think I've always, I could not ignore that spirit. I couldn't make believe, you know, that it's this or that. For me, it's been really attending to what that spirit of God is calling me to. And I guess over time, it has emerged as a prophetic voice. I don't think I would have thought of myself originally in that vein, but I know that I have a mission. You know, I've always, even as a kid, I mean, I know that God wants me to do something in the world. He wants everyone to do something in the world, you know, truthfully. I think everyone has a mission. But I felt that, you know, within my own personhood.
Sure. Well, let's talk about, we for those of us familiar with the life of Thomas Merton, you know, he went, left a very successful career, probably as a writer, teacher, and went to the monastery. And then he, Father Thomas became Father Lewis, I believe. Right. And with the Carmelite, you had to take a name, or you were invited to take a name. Ilya, I think, is what you got to. But walk us through that process, maybe more so for the non-Catholic listeners so they can understand how it works.
Right. So religious life, traditionally, especially monastic life, is considered a second baptism. So it's like a new life in Christ. So just as in baptism, you get a name, you know, for your new life in Christ. So in religious life, you would choose a new name to signify your new identity. You know, it's like you have a new identity in Christ with a new family, and a new way of being in the world. So I was very attracted to the two founders of Carmel. One was the prophet Elijah, from which the Carmelites take their inspiration, their prime inspiration. And the second was the reformer, the great reformer, Teresa of Avila, who I, you know, still remarkable woman. I mean, great faith, herself prophetic, extremely insightful, great spiritual writer. And so I couldn't choose between them. So I thought, well, I'll just take both of them. So I was Teresa Elia, the Greek feminine of Elijah was Elia. And then we had to take a title. And the title was, in a sense, the kind of image of God, or that you know, that spiritual image that would guide our lives. So I took the Trinity. So I was Teresa Elia of the Trinity. And I remember the bishop saying, boy, you really didn't leave anyone out. I mean, you got the whole kit and caboodle here. So I was like, well, I just want to, like, you know, hedge my bets, you know, just to see how things go here. So when I eventually left the Carmelites to join the Franciscans said, well, we have a sister Teresa, but, you know, you can keep the name Elia. But they were German Franciscans, and the way they pronounced it was Ilya. It just is the way it flowed from them. And so I said, well, I kind of like that pronunciation, Ilya, you know.
Ilya.
So,
yeah.
Right. So, So that's how I got to be Ilya Delio. And I thought, well, you know, if I ever become famous, Ilya Delio would be a good name to have because it's unique.
It's very unique.
Yeah. Very
yeah,
unique.
You touched upon the transition. Tell the listeners about that. Started with the Carmelites, that proved to be pretty austere, and at some point you decided you needed to look elsewhere. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, with the Carmelites, after the honeymoon phase wore off, you know, which was the novelty phase, which was about a year and a half or so, maybe a year, and then I found myself doing, like, heavy manual labor. We had a large garden in the back, and then we ran a bakery. And then it was a type of thing, like, it was very, very highly structured, like the church, with a superior that we call the prioress, and then her, you know, right hand, the sub-prioress. And so I was a lowly novice. And so, like, our jobs were assigned to us every morning. I mean, we didn't have a say. But she just said, well, you will be paneling the room today. And I go, oh my God, I don't know. I can't panel a single thing. I'll kill myself. She's like, that's your job.
Right, deal with it.
And yeah, exactly. Deal with it. So she put me in charge of the bakery, which was a nightmare since I only knew where the bakery store was to buy things. I didn't know how to really bake. And I was with these, you know, Ukrainian women who were like, you know, lifting heavy rocks and 50 bag pounds of flour. And I was like, oh, Lord, it was really a lot of work. It was work and prayer. And there was very, very little sociality. Like, we could not walk with one other sister. There was no particular friendships. So you had to walk in at least three or four outside. Otherwise, you were by yourself. And so the idea was the flight of the alone to the alone. Like, you know, you are to journey to God, you know, in the solitude of yourself. And I was like, okay, all right, you know, okay, this honeymoon thing has worn off. This is not normal. So I said, you know, truthfully, I couldn't make sense of it in terms of the incarnation. If God has become flesh, right, if God has become one of us, well, the world's not really a bad place. The world must be a good place since God entered into it. And then, you know, Jesus was very sociable. I mean, he had a lot of disciples and, you know, he went out to dinners. And I thought, this doesn't seem right, you know. And so later on, you know, I realized it was very Neoplatonic, you know, it was very like the Greek contemplative thinkers had this kind of monastic sense of the alone to the alone, you know, very lonely. So after I did bury my degrees, by the way, you know, under the altar. That was, you know, because I was a romantic. Yeah. So, you know, I had this great, like, if this was ever to become a major movie, this would be a great scene. But so I, luckily, it was a movable altar. So that's because God has, you know, divine sense of humor. So, yeah. So we had this little ceremony with one of the Jesuit priests who was one of the confessors, and I buried my degrees. And then I finally realized about year, like right after first vows, I said, I don't think I could do this for life. You know, I think I'll really lose it. So I asked to take a leave of absence. And they hem and hawed about it because they said, we don't really do these things in our way of life. And so they did. They allowed me to take a year. And then they sent me to live with German Franciscans because I went back to research at Rutgers University. But I had to move the altar to get my degrees back eventually. So that's, you know, that's how I kind of exited Carmel. You know, it was highly pressured for me. It was like being in a pressure cooker, you know. Yeah. And I thought it was an unhealthy way of life for me. It may work for others, you know, and if that's their call and they want to be working, you know, 20 hours a day and praying and be removed from the world, then okay, great, good for it, you know. I just think whatever way brings you to God, go for it, you know. Sure. That wasn't my way. So, right. Yeah, so I was happy to be out. I felt like I was let out of the prison or something, you know.
So like, with the Franciscan,
yeah.
You got to pursue education and kind of your interest in science.
I did, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Right. Well, when I went to the Franciscan, I went to them because I was sent to live with them. You know, I never sought to be a Franciscan. I was sent to the Franciscans, which is always kind of an interesting thing, you know. But as you know, and they were very nice, very simple women. They ran a nursing home. That was their principal ministry, and then they ran a home for mentally disabled women in South Jersey. And so, you know, I think what I liked about them was they were very community-minded, but yet they were very structured. So they were conservative. They wore a habit, you know, and they had the structure of religious life, meaning early morning prayer, and then you had the office of the day and the liturgy every morning. So I liked that. I was very structured in my spiritual life. But then, like, we had parties on Sunday. The Germans like to drink beer on Sunday. They were generous, you know, and then they allowed me to go back to research at Rutgers University. But that was kind of weird because I really had nothing in common with the sisters, you know, as a scientist. I mean, I would come home and they would ask me how my rats were doing. And I thought, okay, this is not going to be sustainable for the long term.
Right.
Yeah. So I wasn't sure. I mean, I had no, actually, I didn't ask to go into theology. They called me in one day and said, you know, we'd like you to consider studying, going to school for spirituality. And I said, what? I don't know much about spirituality. And I said, well, how about theology? I had to take a theology course in college. And they said, okay, that's fine. So, so they sent me for a master's degree at Fordham because I had to go to a Catholic school.
Sure.
And I thought, oh, this is really fun, you know. So, yeah, once I started theology, I thought, wow. I would say I was like a fish who found water, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you continued teaching. Walk us through kind of the different degrees and the different places you've taught theology.
Oh, yeah.
Theology and so
yeah,
forth.
Yeah. So I got the master's and I stayed on for the doctorate in theology. And then the sisters said I would have to work. I said, what work? Are you kidding? So, I just thought for me, I thought my job was to be a sister in community. I never even thought that I would teach or do anything like this. But, you know, they called me in, the superior called me in. She said, you're going to have to get a job. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay. So I applied for, I think I was about to graduate, and there was a opening at Trinity College in Hartford as a adjunct professor, and I applied for it, and I got it, like, you know, just after going to the interview. And then while I'm waiting online to graduate, another sister was graduating with me, and she said, I'm going to Washington Theological Union. You know, there are going to be two openings down there, and I'm sure I'll get one of them. I said, oh, that's nice. Good for you. You know, and then that summer, a friar called me, a Franciscan friar, and he said, there's two openings at WTU, and you should apply for one. And I said, oh, you know, well, so-and-so's applying, and she'll probably get it. He said, no, you should apply. So I applied, and we were both interviewed in the same week, and I got the job. So I was like, oh, my God, okay, that's amazing. So, yeah, I started Washington Theological Union, which was a graduate school of theology and ministry. The school was owned by five religious orders, like the Franciscans, the Carmelites, the Redemptorists, the Augustinians, and maybe one or two others. So it was really where there were a lot of young brothers, you know, priests in formation, and then sisters. And then we had a big sabbatical program in my first years there, a lot of religious from around the world. Mm-hmm. And it was great. I loved it. I taught church history, and then I taught spirituality, all different courses. And then I became the director of the Franciscan center there. So I did all sorts of courses in Franciscan theology and spirituality. And it was a real eye-opener in terms of the church, in terms of religious life. It's the first time I ever probably realized that there were gay people in religious life. I was like, what? You know, because I came from Cradle Catholic New Jersey, where I was like, what? You know, that kind of just got blocked out of everything.
That was a surprise, what you're saying.
It was a huge surprise. Yeah, and everything was really just an eye-opener. I lived, for example, in an apartment building that I dubbed Nuns Towers because there were like 25 sisters who lived in this building of 60 apartments. So, you know, a third or more of the building were sisters. And they were all the women who helped shape Vatican II, with religious life after Vatican II. And mm-hmm. I started the job in a habit, and they would all be like, why are you wearing that thing? And I'm like, what's your problem? I couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand me, but we became friends. And it was just talking with this woman and just being with them and listening to their stories that really opened me up to what Vatican II was about and the changes in the church. And you know, over time, I really came to appreciate their incredible, you know, what they've done in terms of education, in terms of social work, and the changes they made in their own lives. And I began to take a different look at the habit, you know, that it was a set of clothes that had an identity, but it doesn't define who you are as a sister or, you know, someone committed to the gospel life. So it took me a long time to transition from the habit, but I eventually my horizon widened, you know, by living with these women.
When did you let go of the habit? Because it is a dominant theme in the book.
You're wearing the habit,
and you're fine with it, and people are teasing you about it.
Yeah, they are. You know, like, because, you know, like, I think some sisters were like embarrassed, you know, that I still wore a veil and stuff. And I was like, I couldn't understand, like, why, you know, it was their problem. And so, you know, we grow up in cultures, you know, that have symbolic meaning and signifiers. And I was coming from a particular culture where the habit had signification, you know, for personal identity as a religious. And these women had already broke those boundaries. You know, they had broken through them and moved on. But I couldn't quite get that at the point. I guess, you know, one day, Sister Catherine Pinkerton, who worked for a network, really an incredible Sister St. Joseph. I mean, really a firebrand, you know, who lobbied on Capitol Hill for housing for the poor. And, you know, I mean, really incredible work. She said to me one day, Ilya, we have to tell you about, you know, the Sisters Formation Conference and what has taken place over the last 50 years. You've got to be brought up to date. You know, just like, they were going to make it their mandate to educate me, you know, to get me up to speed. Anyway, that's, yeah, I think living and working with those sisters and then listening, to me, it's, you know, friendship and communication is what changes our worldviews. And I think we get locked into worldviews when we get very cut off from people who are different from us, you know, when we don't communicate with them. And so that was a great, a great lesson for me to be with these women of Vatican II and hear their stories. And then to realize the apartment I was living in was the apartment where the sister who lived there before me wrote this book called The Transformation of the American Catholic Sisterhood, which basically formed, caused a split in terms of religious women in this country. And out of that grew the LCWR and then, you know, the Conference of Major Religious Superiors. Two very different worldviews, two different ideologies with regard to religious life, still to this day, you know. Two very different, very much like the church, you know, very split, very divided. Yeah. So I think a part of me has always wanted to reconcile things. Like, can we move beyond these things to, you know, a new unity, a new body?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in your case, not only was the habit, you were, I think, very resistant to Vatican II for years. And maybe
it was
the stretch at the Nun Tower that moved you on the other side of Vatican II. But did that transformation come over that time as well?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it took a long time for me, actually, to appreciate what Vatican II is about. I was such a traditionalist. I mean, a staunch traditionalist, ultra traditionalist. I was to the right of Attila the Hun. I was Attila the Nun. Yeah. So, I mean, and I don't know if it was part of my cradle Catholicism or I had, you know, I was, you know, very impressed by the nun story and, you know, Brideshead Revisited and, you know, like the image of the nun was in my mind. I was supposed to look this way and act this way. So anything that, you know, tampered with that had to be wrong. And it took me a long, long time to realize that religious life is made up of, you know, just people, you know, ordinary people who are called in some ways to commit their lives to the gospel and maybe doing extraordinary things, you know, but I think I also came to realize at Nun's Towers that, you know, I met a lot of different people who were doing extraordinary things in very ordinary ways. You know, like the woman who helped the elderly gentleman every week with his laundry, and she drove all the way from Pennsylvania to do that. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. You know, so I guess my worldview on religious life really opened up there, you know, and being and teaching at WTU and realizing the church is made up of all sorts of different people. And and so this kind of need in the church to, you know, to be kind of a whitewashed, you know, pure church and, you know, very highly structured church. I thought, no, this isn't right. This is not right. You know, the church is really grounded in fragile humanity. And we're all sort of making our way, you know, through this humanity into what we can be. God. So anyway, that's my sojourn at WTU.
Outstanding. Okay, what next? And we have the WTU and we have the Nun Tower, and then what's the next important chapter?
Oh, from Vivi to you. Right. I got a call from Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University, just out of the blue, really, by this Father John Hoy. And he said, we'd like to invite you to come down and give us a talk on your work on creation theology. So I was like, well, okay, you know, I had heard of Woodstock. I knew nothing about it. I didn't even know where Georgetown was. I knew it was in D.C. So I found my way down there. And yeah, this group of, I would say older, they were older than me, but not that much older, but, you know, older, mostly Jesuits, but also lay people involved in questions of the day. This Woodstock Theological Center, and then they invited me to become an associate fellow with them. And I was like, wow, that's different, you know. And yeah. I could see Woodstock, Washington Theological Union was having a lot of internal problems in terms of the administration. There's a lot of turnover, and then there was, you know, some financial problems, and then it looked like the school did have a very finite future from where I was standing. And I thought, well, Woodstock has reached out. Maybe I should move in that direction. So I took the chance, and I was invited to become a senior fellow at Woodstock, and I took it. And it was the right thing to do, since the Washington Theological Union closed just a few years after I left. Yeah, so then I went to work with the Jesuits, and then I worked with this fabulous Jesuit, John Hoy, who was really a mentor to me, this tall, lanky Jesuit who I spent like every day with. You know, we would just talk for hours about, you know, just different subjects. And he was really, I've learned a lot about how, you know, how to pursue questions and kind of pursuit of knowledge. And it was a really interesting endeavor because we would undertake research projects and they'd be collaborative with other faculty from Georgetown. And yeah, it was a way of doing a scholarship that was really, it was novel and it was really engaging, and I really, yeah, came to really enjoy it. And then Woodstock closed. So someone said, everywhere you go, it seems to close. I'm like, oh dear, it's not good. Then I was asked if I wanted to spearhead Catholic studies at Georgetown once Woodstock closed. And I said, well, okay. So I did that. That was a little challenging with the dean at that point who was there. This lovely family had donated quite a bit of money to Catholic studies, and I had a big vision for Catholic studies at Georgetown, but the dean did not have the same vision, and so it was a little conflicted. And in the meantime, while I was there, my friend Tom Rees, a Jesuit, you know, used to say to me, you should have an endowed chair. And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, well, yeah, sure. So I don't know how I saw this position opened up at Villanova for an endowed chair and the Connolly chair. And I was like, ah, what the heck? You know, I didn't know anyone. I didn't know anything. I just decided to throw my hat in the ring. And yeah, next thing I know, I got a call for an interview. Yeah, and that was that, you know, and the rest is history. So
yeah.
I got the job, and here I am.
Are you still teaching at Villanova? Yes, yes, yes.
I am.
Fantastic. Let me. I don't know where this fits, but then you've got a chapter on self-discovery, falling in love anew, and then also on kind of starting a new community. So I'm somewhere in that time frame, maybe it's the, you know, discarding the habit and the reforms of Vatican II or what, but just kind of unpack that for us, if you will.
Yeah. So, you know, I've got unhabited and started really just, you know, being more at home with who I am and just becoming friends with other people. And then I did fall in love with a sister, you know, I mean, and it's something I would have never thought about. I mean, it just never crossed my mind, you know, but it also just, you know, spoke to me, I think, of something, you know, maybe that I've always kind of known implicitly, but never really, because I was brought up cradle Catholic, you just didn't even go down that route, you know, to think about it. But I also like men. So I think, you know, I think I'm somewhere what they call pansexual or something like that, you know, both sides or bi or something like that. But I was really at home in that relationship. But then I also said, well, wait a minute. I committed my life, you know, as a sister, you know, and I had to say, well, this is right, but not right, you know. So, yeah, so I did choose not to pursue it as an intimate relationship, but, you know, as a friendship. And, yeah, it's gone on, you know, life has proceeded on since then. But it was a good thing to do for me to know who I am, you know, and yeah. to be at home with who I am. And so that was okay. And then from there, yeah, and then what happens from that?
Well, you talk about the time, new community at some point.
So my German community was really dwindling. Again, a lot of power structure problems, administrative problems. The novice director had some real issues, and everyone who entered the community, every American woman left the community. I was like the last one to hang on. And really a lot of psychological problems there. And I, as I was growing in my identity as a person, as a Franciscan, as a sister, I just developed a whole different, you know, view of the world and of God and things that was different from the community. And they were good to me in the sense that they gave me the freedom to explore these things. And so I asked to, you know, and then Lisa was living in the building above me with another sister, and she became my kind of best buddy. And we started talking together about founding this new community. And she had been in her community for 37 years.
Wow.
Which is a long time. Yeah, big established, yes, community. But we've both felt it was time to, I mean, I love the Franciscan charism, but sometimes it's too stuck in the Middle Ages. It can't seem to kind of find its way into the 21st century. And I thought, I want to take the richness of this charism and bring it into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have really a plan. I mean, I just felt like I would listen to the spirit and the spirit would lead me. I probably should have had more of a plan, but I didn't. But it's funny how God works through all these things. I mean, you know, again, every time I think, oh, I'll be doing this or that, it closed or it ended, and then something new emerged. So I've just stopped now after a while, stopped planning. And I just say, well, God, what are we doing today? You know, what's happening? So we did move to Washington back in 2006, and we had we were doing everything. We were doing the formation work. We were doing the liturgies. We were doing retreat work. We were working full time, and it was exhausting, you know, and then all these women would come and go and stuff. And we did have two women who eventually joined us, you know, but it never really grew in the way I think I had in mind. And maybe what I had in mind, maybe it was not entirely feasible for today. And yet it's precisely because we began this new entity that I began also the center for what we call today the Center for Christogenesis or the Omega Center. Like, I still have a vision and a call that Franciscan theology can indeed be, you know, the vital theology for our age today. But I, you know, began to spell that out through the insights of Teilhard de Chardin, who I think, you know, who was a Jesuit, but I think was very Franciscan, you know, in his outlook. And so I really developed and tried to develop Teilhard's vision for the 21st century. But I'm still deeply Franciscan, you know, it's still deeply rooted. And so it's sort of a Franciscan Teilhardian vision at the heart of the Center for Christogenesis. And
yes.
It's funny, you know, like our community hasn't grown, but the center has grown immensely. And so maybe this is what God had in mind. You know, maybe our understanding of religious life has to change. And that's what I've begun to see. You know, we impose these, like, this is what it's supposed to look like. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe that, you know, maybe it had its day then, and maybe something new has to emerge. And that's what I find myself now, in that emerging newness.
Mm. Walk us through, many will be familiar with the Omega Center. That's when I was working with the board. That was the name, and there's been a name change. But walk us through that so folks can maybe better appreciate why the name change and maybe better appreciate the current vision.
Yeah. Teilhard de Chardin, for those who are not familiar, was a French Jesuit who was a paleontologist. And he had a great devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Being Jesuit, he had a deep commitment to Christ. And, you know, the Ignatian idea of finding Christ in all things. But he brought that together with his insights and studies as a scientist. And so he devoted his career to bringing faith and science, or religion and science, together. And he thought that Christianity was indeed a religion of evolution. In other words, it is the religion where we have, you know, divinity or God in materiality, and this breath of the spirit, you know, pulling material formation into something new. And so that he said, you know, that this whole universe is, you know, is God made flesh in formation, that the whole thing is, in a sense, the formation of Christ. And so Omega was the term he used to talk about God. You know, God is the beginning and the end, you know, towards the source of our lives and the goal towards which we are moving. But he said that end is already now. That end is in the beginning. The end towards what we seek is already within us. And it's the power that's moving us and moving all of evolution towards, you know, towards its new life, towards the fullness of Christ. And so I've really devoted a lot of my work in the last, maybe the last 5 to 10 years, trying to illuminate what Teilhard was saying there. What does it mean to talk about a power of love, divine love within us, a God who is intimately present to us, a God who is yet our future, who can never be contained by anything material, but is always more than anything we can ask or imagine. And so the universe, you know, where we are, is not just stuff. It's not just, you know, this biological place called the universe. It's where God is doing new things, you know. And so it's a vision of hope. It's a vision of trust and of faith, and to say that we're part of what the Christ is becoming, you know. And I think we oftentimes, the church never really preached that to us, you know. I mean, when I was a kid, Jesus Christ, we always used to bow our head at the name of Christ because it was such a sacred name. But I thought Christ was Jesus's last name, you know, and I think a lot of people, every time I say that, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, I have the same thought, you know. But no, it's Jesus, the Christ, right? The Messiah, the anointed one. And we're part of that, you know. Like when we wake up and get a new consciousness of what it means to have God at work in our lives, like we become part of that Christ. Mm. And that's what Teilhard was really trying to say. Like, we are that Christ in formation. You know, it does matter to God and to the world how we choose and what we do with our lives. And so the Center for Christogenesis is really trying to break open that vision for a world today of science and technology and economics and plurality and racism and, you know, politicization and all the complexities we find ourselves in. God is here, you know, working through it all, working in our lives. And I'm saying we need to know this God in a new way. We need to know that our lives matter to God. We need to know that God is becoming ever more God in and through us. So it's a very exciting vision, you know. I think it's a very dynamic vision. It's not the passive, just show up for church and, you know, and God will bless you. You know, it's much more engaging, because God is more engaging than we've made God out to be.
Yes.
No, that's my center.
Optimistic. Yeah, optimistic and exciting and dynamic.
It is optimistic. Yes, I think we're too pessimistic. I mean, how can you believe in God and be a pessimist? I don't know. I certainly can't believe in the risen Christ and be a pessimist, right? You know, I think
yes.
We have to have hope, you know, and then, you know, we have to, well, what's the basis of our hope? You know, what do we hope for? And what gets us up in the morning? What gives fire to our lives? You know, what impassions us? I mean, religion just can't be this, you know, can't be boring. It can't be just a staid or rote, you know, set of formulas that you've memorized. I mean, so trying to change that whole thing there. That's what we're about.
And you're doing a great job. I know when I first met you, I picked up the same spirit that I'm picking up now, just energetic, happy, optimistic, and it's very much continues to be obviously a part of the work you're doing. How do folks join you in your work? How do they follow you? I know you've got books come out all the time. You're probably still speaking. How does a website work? How can people follow what you're doing?
Well, they can go to www.centerforchristogenesis.org, and you'll find the website there. If you Google my name on Amazon, you'll find a list of my books there. Or Villanova, if you go to Villanova, I have a website there. So I think any of those, internet vehicles of communication will be helpful to gain, you know, get in, see through the window of the world of Ilia Delio.
Yeah, fantastic. One or two more questions and I'll let you go. Just wrote an article that I thought was very well written and very challenging, and probably only you could pull it off, but, you know, criticizing the institutional Catholic Church. Give us some of your thoughts on that, if you will.
Well, you know, as I reflect, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do like Pope Francis, and I do like, you know, his efforts. But, you know, I stepped back and I look at the world and I say, we have enough politicians, we have enough economic policies, we have a lot of, you know, a lot of bodies that can help, you know, make public policies around these matters. What we don't have is a credible understanding of God. And so I think, why doesn't the church, do what it's best at doing? And that's theology, you know, like the helping develop a spirituality for a world of plurality and complexity, where there are still polarizations. And so I wanted to step back and say, look, if the church is going to talk about brotherhood and sisterhood and cosmic family and social justice and how we need to change our economic policies, it might begin by just looking at itself. Since, this is a very Franciscan thing. Like, so St. Francis, you know, had a lot to say on these matters. And he said to St. Clare, you know, why look at the outside when the inside is better? Be attentive to the inner spirit. Second is, he said, Claire said to her sisters, we must be mirror and example to one another. We must model what we are holding out for the world. You know, we must be mirror and example to one another so that we can be mirror and example to the world. And I thought, yeah, that's the church, right? What if the church was the mirror and the example of, you know, cosmic fraternity and social justice? I mean, I'm all for, you know, social justice, but I mean, the Vatican Bank has, you know, quite a little fortune there. You know, the papacy itself in terms of administration and hierarchy. How do you talk about, you know, justice when it's a completely male hierarchy, when there's not one little, you know, space for a woman to really, and someone will say, oh, well, the Pope allows women chancellors or something, but there's no way a woman could get into the Roman Curia. You know, there's no way.
Right.
So, you know, the church has work to do. If it wants to be a credible voice in the world, it must work on itself first before telling the world what it needs to be doing. And I think, you know, people would really respect if the church opened up to women priests, if it would open up to women bishops, to the possibility of a woman pope, to being more inclusive in terms of the LGBTQ community, divorced and remarried persons. You know, people are suffering. You know, why all these legal regulations as if we know what God, you know, will God judge? Well, how do you know what God judges? We judge ourselves. I think God is really full of compassion, quite honestly. I always say, thank God God is not us in some ways, because we're very hard on one another, quite honestly. And the church, you know, needs to let go. Those days, you know, there's some things that need to let go, and maybe a new way of seeing God at work in the world today. And maybe it can decentralize itself. I mean, do we really need the Vatican structure as it is? You know, what if we rethought leadership in the church? Maybe subsidiarity, maybe have, you know, local churches having a little bit more power in them and I always think maybe a good model would be the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. They have a good way of leadership. You know, communities still have their own central, you know, their own authoritative voices, but, you know, they all kind of come together and agree on things. And I don't know, we have a lot of work in the church. And so I'm just saying it can't stay as it is. You talk to young people today, religion does not hold a significant voice for many young people. It's not that they're against religion. It just is not, it's not on their radar screen, you know. And I think this is what we need. We need a God who we know loves us and is involved in our lives. We need a credible God for a new world. So I think the church cannot just keep mandating public policies. It needs to work on itself. It needs to change and to show the world that change can bring about a renewed spirit. So.
Amen.
I thank you for your prophetic voice.
You know, we talked about that before we started, that, you know, to have somebody still on the inside like you be able to critique the institution is, you know, prophetic position. And I thank you for your voice. I think your voice speaks to a points out a lot of structural problems in it, and the ultimate optimism and the ultimate theology, you know, so grounded in Christ and God's love is evident and apparent. So I just thank you, Ilya, for all you're doing. Keep up the good work, and we're not going to let you ride bikes by yourself, because sometimes you have crashes, right? Make sure you wear helmets. Now, somewhere I saw a picture, and that's the only other thing I wanted to ask you, because I just thought it was hysterical. I know you're born in New Jersey and you're a Bruce Springsteen fan, but did I see a picture at one point of like the Singing Nuns or something? Even when you were a Carmelite,
Yes. Mm-hmm. When I was a Carmelite, we cut an album, actually. I used to write songs in my when I wasn't in the bakery or the garden. So I love music. And so, yeah, I wrote some songs on guitar and piano, and we cut this album, and there I am playing guitar and harmonica and, you know, I think a xylophone or something. Yeah, so that was me, the Singing Nun.
The Singing Nun, that's outstanding. All right, sister, thank you so much for your time. Been a pleasure catching up with you again, as always, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Mike, for all the work you're doing as well. All right.
You're welcome.